Welcome to the What's Next Sports podcast, where each week we will be taking a look back at the main headlines from the previous 7 days. We'll be offering you insights, opinion, hot takes and headline acts from the world of sport. You can follow the podcast on Instagram at whatsnext.pod and Twitter at whatsnextsport. Listen, feedback, enjoy and as always, trust the process. We've made it to episode 20, but it's just the two of us today, Tinnis. Jimmy is out on the golf course perfecting his swing. I've been out with him a couple of times the last week or so, actually. He's playing nicely, so I'm sure he'll be winning at the moment. But that being said, maybe something coming on the golf front down the line, if we can persuade you to take up the game. So keep your eyes peeled for that. But Tinnis, how are you, pal? How are things going?
You've got no chance of me playing golf for one. It's far too cold right now for you to persuade us to do that. But other than that, no, I'm good, thanks. Still no taste of smell. I told you, I'd keep you updated with that. But not all well. Looking forward to the season getting going this weekend for both of us, I think, for the cricket season. So yeah, good, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. I think last night at training, got a bit of an insight into what the weekend might look like, which was feels like temperatures of about -4 and a snowy blizzard. So you might not see me doing too much at the weekend. I've also broken my bat, so that could be me retiring before the season's even started. But positive, but that's cricket for you. Shall we get through some headlines from the past 7 days or so before we move on?
Yeah, mate, go for it. It's a headline that your bat's broken. I know it's a thing you hold very close to your heart.
That bat has served me for near a decade, I reckon. And at times it served me well, at times it has done me no favours, but I'll miss it. I might frame it.
Yeah, definitely the headline to start with.
The last 7 days, Doigy broke his bat. Major League Baseball is back. Nate Diaz is also back. He is scheduled to fight England's Leon Edwards in the UFC. Germany lost to North Macedonia after Werner missed a sitter and England went 3-from-3 in their qualifiers. The police were called to the Stadium of Light as Oxford United goalkeeper Jack Stevens was headbutted in the tunnel at half-time. Sachin Tendulkar has been hospitalised with COVID. The Women's Six Nations got underway with a comfortable win for England. The English teams did well in the Challenge Cup, whilst it was the French teams doing well in the Champions Cup, unless you are Toulon, who were knocked out, having failed to field a side on COVID grounds. Hamish Watson was named Six Nations Player of the Tournament. De Kock was at his shithousery best. Brathwaite scored a ton wearing sunglasses. The Raptors recorded a win over the Golden State Warriors by a record margin. West Brom pumped Chelsea. Aubameyang and Stuart Atwell had a bad lid competition. Mike Brown has confirmed his move to the Falcons. And Beth Potter broke the British woman's 5K record, running a 14:41. Gerwyn Price is out of the Premier League darts, having also tested positive for COVID. Mourinho said that Alderweireld wasn't available for Spurs, having not trained. And then the Spurs media team posted a video on Twitter of Son in training with Alderweireld in the background. So something's not adding up there. Rebecca Welsh became the first female referee in the English Football League as she took charge of the League Two clash between Harrogate and Port Vale. John Rahm named his child Kepa Cahill, apparently being a massive Chelsea fan. Mavericks ended Bath's unbeaten Super League run. Rangers drew Celtic in the Cup. And lastly, Liverpool lost to Madrid and City beat Dortmund in the Champions League as De Bruyne extended his City stay until 2025 at least. Any of those to touch upon quickly?
One thing I want to raise is Timo Werner an absolute myth, or is he just having one of those seasons where it just hasn't quite clicked for him, and then give it two, three years in England, he will be a top striker? Or is he really just going to be a really bang average player from now on? I hope he comes good purely out of the fact that I started feeling a bit sorry for him, because it was an absolute sitter he missed.
Jimmy thinks he might be part of the package Chelsea put forward to try and bring Haaland to Stamford Bridge. Thinks him plus cash.
That's not a bad shout to be put, because he'll go back to Germany. I'm sure he'll bag a load. Because evidently it's a bit too quick for him over here so far, which is why I think he eventually would get good. But yeah, I just think that was something I had to raise. As a Liverpool fan, I don't really want to talk about the game, but they weren't overly great against a pretty bang average Real Madrid when you look at their defence as well as our defence. It then just proved that their midfielders of Kroos and Modric are miles ahead of what we've got of buying Thiago. But I don't want to talk about that too much. So I don't know if any of those headlines stuck out to you, though.
I picked the wrong game from that one last night. I got in from training. I watched the end of the City game, which was actually quite a good watch. It was two decent teams. I thought Dortmund actually were closer to City than I thought they would be. But then again, De Bruyne, his final ball is just phenomenal. And obviously him extending his contract as well, announcing he's there till 2025. Maybe that is just the continuation of City's dominance in the league, or maybe it is with a desire to obviously win the Champions League and get over the line. But he was quality. But I think probably cricket steals the headlines. Obviously, the county championship returns tomorrow, possibly. Durham were netting in the snow up here yesterday, the day before, as we were. But I think either the headline of de Kock running out, was it Farzan when he was on 195?
Yeah.
Was, I don't know what side of the fence I sit on it. I think I sit on the funny side of it. You don't fall for that. You make sure you slide your bat, etc. That's what you tell all the youngsters. Or Brathwaite as captain, batting in sunglasses, scoring a ton. And I can't quite work out again whether that is cool or whether that is another West Indian trying to be Chris Gayle. But both of them headline worthy, both of them amusing. I'm not sure whether you saw either of them, but both of them putting cricket in the mainstream.
I saw the de Kock one, and that was, it's a case of it's funny because he shouldn't have fallen for it. He should have done what Smith did when Johnny Bairstow tried doing the full dive in. You don't get 190 odd and then do something like that. I think that was schoolboy from him and clever from the captain. I didn't see the Brathwaite one, if I'm honest, but credit to him. If you're going to do it and get 100, then it's fair enough. It's better if he'd done it and nicked off first ball, everyone would absolutely slate him. So credit to him. Why not? He's never going to be Chris Gayle. He absolutely blocked it, didn't he, Brathwaite? But no, I'm quite all right with both of them, I think.
Well, I was thinking with the glasses thing, is it allowed? Because potentially he's wearing the glasses. I know fielders do it and they sort of, they make the red more enhanced so you see it better. Are you allowed to do that? I mean, clearly, because he did it, so he's
I suppose it must be if he's gone out and done it, because there has been players in the past, and like you say, Chris Gayle's done it, there's been a couple of other West Indians that have done it, and I suppose it's, if the fielders can use it, then why can't the batters use it? It's the bowlers use it. Why? What's the reasoning behind it? All that a batter couldn't use it. So I'm sure it'll be something that people are looking to and probably slay them for some reason. But yeah, credit to him.
Well, I think as long as he's scoring hundreds, there'll be a fair few people following it on. Be interesting to see if many people pick it up in the IPL if they start doing it under the lights or whatever. But we'll see. I might try it.
Be a brave person in the IPL. They'll sneak off first ball and not get picked again. But there we go. So those are the headlines. Doig, I think you've got our headline this week, which I think is quite a good one. It's a long one, but it's well worth the listen. So what's next?
Yeah, my headline act this week is one of the most recognisable figures in the Vitality Super League at the moment. Director of High Performance and head coach of the Leeds Rhinos team, Dan Ryan. I spoke to Dan about having a high performance mentality, growing a new franchise from recruitment to playing style, establishing goals, being a figurehead within netball, and also how to ensure that the sport and the league continues to grow after this year within a pandemic. It was an incredible 45 minutes or so. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking to him. I'm sure you'll all enjoy listening to it. So enjoy. Dan, a massive thank you for joining us, especially in the middle of the season with plenty going on. So we really appreciate your time. Firstly, as always with our guests, how are you? How are things going at the moment?
Yeah, going very well, mate. Thank you so much for having me, and just enjoying a couple of days break after a doubleheader weekend. And then, looking forward to getting stuck into some matches in about 10 days time. So not a lot of rest, but we'll take a break whenever we can, to be honest.
For sure. Before we get into the season, we talk about that and upcoming fixtures, etc. Netball's just returned in the community scene. Every sport has just started to return, and community sport, recreational sport is allowed to come back. It's a massive thing. How important is that going to be to sort of tag on to the second half of the netball season at the Super League and allow people to be out there enjoying the sport that they love, not just watching it at the moment, but also playing it alongside?
Yeah, critical, to be honest. I think it's, it's been such a luxury for us, I guess, in the elite framework as elite athletes and coaches to still be able to play our sport during the lockdown periods and, I guess, be able to wake up every day and have a purpose in going to work and going to training. I think we've been extremely grateful for that. And, you know, the gratitude comes from the understanding that there's so many people that haven't been able to play the game they love for so long. So Such an important, I guess, little milestone for all those community netballers out there to reconnect with their teammates and get on the court and start getting fit and active again. And hopefully that all the netball they've been watching through the Super League has not only inspired the incumbent players in community netball, but also maybe a new wave of people to the game as well. So we hope that the spectatorship of games continues, but also really understand the importance of people now getting out there again and I guess reconnecting with their social communities, which is so important now.
Can you give us and our listeners a little background of who you are, your story, and how you've ended up where you are now?
Yeah, so I'm 36. I'm from Victoria in Australia. I grew up in country Victoria with three brothers and mum and dad. And netball has been a part of my life since I was a young kid. My mum played a lot when she was younger, and vividly remember sitting on the side of a court watching her play. And I started playing the game myself when I was 8 years old and was quite fortunate enough to just, I guess, be quite good at it from an early age, but was really obsessed with it, to be honest, and practiced in the backyard every single day with mum. And she taught me all the skills and drills and all the rules. And by the age of 15, I was playing in the Victorian men's team and the Australian men's team, and had a career in, I guess, elite level men's netball for about 15 years or so. And during that time, I was also studying to be a journalist. That's my main qualification. And so obviously went through university and all those types of things. But really when I started playing netball at the high level around 15, 16, I started coaching. And coaching, I guess, was a natural progression for me to utilize my knowledge and love of the game in a different capacity. And it really started off as something that was more of a hobby and a casual job to get a bit of pocket money. And it didn't really become a career avenue for me until about 2012. So I was always balancing dual careers by working in the media as a netball commentator on Australian TV, and also doing some international coverage as well, with my coaching on the side. And as it turned out, the coaching became the full-time job and the broadcasting and media work became more of the part-time freelance casual hobby. So coaching's taking me all over the world. I've lived in three countries and six cities around the world coaching, and never in my wildest dreams expected that would be the lifestyle that I've been fortunate enough to live. But, you know, as one of very few professional male coaches in the world, really grateful for the opportunities I've had. And yeah, like I said, at only 36, I still feel at the very start of my high performance coaching career, but have a lot of experience and a lot of diverse experiences under my belt. So yeah, very lucky that I can turn my life's passion into my work and be paid to do it. But it's a great position to be in when you get up every day and go to work and love what you do. So there's challenges with that as well, but a lifetime's work in netball, I guess, and it's given me a lot and certainly have a great passion for the sport.
That's awesome. You are currently head coach of the Leeds Rhinos netball team, 2021 being their first season in the Super League, having announced a couple of years ago when entering the 2019, I think, National Performance League with the younger age groups. Can you tell us a little bit about that whole process of taking charge of a new entity and the birth and building of something, I guess, to where we are now?
Yeah, well, that was the exciting prospect, I think, with being offered the job and the attraction to it for me was that it was a completely unique experience to anything I've ever been a part of before. And I think when you work in high performance professional sport, it's very rare that you get the opportunity to be a part of something from the very beginning of it. Quite often as a coach, you're inheriting a team after a coach has been let go, or there's been some drama or a turmoil, or if you're lucky enough, you actually get to inherit a team that's in a good place or a program that's in a good place. So quite often it's always around a succession of someone else, and you inherit a lot of somebody else's program or a club's program, etc. But with Leeds Rhinos, it was presented as a blank canvas, and whatever we were going to create was going to be authentically ours, and we had the opportunity to really build it from the ground up. So the reality when accepting the job was there was nothing in place from a Super League perspective. There was no real staffing structure. There was no program. There were obviously no athletes. There was no fan base. There was nothing. So the whole project to build it from the ground up has been really quite fascinating and rewarding, to be honest. And recruiting a playing group that was willing to buy into what we were trying to create, and building a full-time training program that was, you know, a process to professionalize the game here in the UK and almost become a benchmark destination and a benchmark standard of performance in the country was what we were striving for. And just seeing all the people in all the different areas, be it in the administrative side, the performance support staff, the actual playing group themselves, the contribution that everyone is making to bring it to life, has been incredible, to be honest. And, you know, the biggest process for us was around just building a framework and an infrastructure that was sustainable, that wasn't dependent on me as the head coach being here forever or the senior player being there forever. It was to build something that was robust and durable where people could come and go over time, but the bones of it always stayed strong and sturdy. So I think what we're building in year one is absolutely that. And we're proving that, you know, the bones are good, the program's good, the people we've invested in are worth the investment. And hopefully it just holds the club in good stead for the years to come, because the Yorkshire region is a very, very proud netball region with a lot of participants. And to not have professional netball or elite netball in that space for the past 4 or 5 years has been really damaging to the region. So to now give them that hope and inspiration that we are the destination for Yorkshire and we are the pathway for those younger athletes, I think is really critical. So it's been quite a complex project, but certainly one that I'm so glad that I've taken. It's been a really refreshing opportunity in my career. And I've just loved seeing everyone make a contribution, no matter what their role has been in it.
There is a shared network, I suppose, as part of the Leeds Rhinos family of clubs. How important is that for the netball side of it, the netball aspect of the family? Is there scope for idea sharing at the top level as well as facility sharing and other bits and pieces there?
Yeah, so what's been really impressive from my perspective is just the full investment and embracement from the rugby department and the actual club itself to embrace netball as part of the family. We're not just a sidearm of the business. We are fully immersed as a part of the business and the organization. Obviously, we haven't been able to see some of the full rewards of that because of COVID. Like, we haven't been obviously able to integrate the three teams or 4 or 5 teams that we have within the club because of the restrictions. We haven't been able to access, I guess, the gym facilities and those kind of things. So we've had to be a little bit different and creative in what our programming looks like. But I think it's more just the fact that we are a part of something that is much, much bigger than just playing netball, and it's more than just a netball team. And we've had some great days at the club where Gary Hetherington and Jamie Jones Buchanan have kind of got involved and really given us an insight as to what this club's all about. And, you know, for the players still, you know, during a global pandemic to feel so connected and embraced and welcomed and a part of the huge Rhinos community has been really powerful. So it's very unique. I think, you know, there are some other clubs here in the UK that are associated with rugby sides in certain ways, but I certainly don't think the level of investment that they make is as big as what Leeds Rhinos make. So yeah, we're really proud to be part of it. And we can absolutely feel that full force. And, you know, I just look forward to the day when, you know, the COVID restrictions, I guess, are lifted as such, and we can really, you know, get to the rugby games, get to the functions, really be embraced and be seen and visible, which I think is really important. But so far we've really felt it in the ways that, you know, have been restricted, but still very powerful and impactful, which has been great.
You touched on it just before there. What were the recruitment processes like, and how difficult were some of those bedding ins as a result of COVID prior to the season starting a couple of months ago?
Well, I think if you ask any head coach, recruitment is the worst period of your coaching life. It's really stressful, to be honest, and very challenging, not only for the coaches, but for the athletes as well. And I think some of the systems and processes that England Netball and the Super League have in place in the recruitment period really need to be looked at, because it caused a lot of issues for a lot of clubs. And unfortunately for us as a brand new team going in, we weren't able to recruit at the same time as the 10 other franchises. So we had to wait 2 weeks before we could start approaching players and signing players and things like that. So that was really, really challenging. However, we knew that we had a really good offer in terms of the program and the brand and the coaching and the staff and the infrastructure. We were really confident that that would attract some high quality players that wanted to be training in a full-time capacity. I guess what we did have as the selling point was the full-time training program, where the athletes have a training commitment every day, where a lot of other franchises are not in a position to do that. So, and also to in that, there were some players during the recruitment that we spoke to that weren't able to make that commitment. So they obviously weren't suitable for us moving forward. But the group that we've ended up with is, as our inaugural squad, have really embraced the daily training environment, and we've seen great rewards from their commitment to that. And, you know, we wanted to make sure we ticked a few boxes in terms of ensuring that we had a couple of homegrown athletes in the squad to ensure that we gave the team a very strong Yorkshire identity. And we also wanted to make sure that we earmarked emerging talent that were at an age that could provide the club with a core group of players that could be sustainable for the next 4, 5, 6 years. So the average age of our group is actually only 22 years of age. And you know, you've got players like a Jade Clark, who's our senior most player at 37, and she's our captain and fee toner at, you know, 30 as well. Those players so critical to nurture the emerging talent coming through the ranks. So there's a lot of little boxes that we had to tick in terms of getting the blend of talent and getting the blend of youth and experience, and also getting the characters of the people right to ensure that they complemented each other nicely, and also to build a team that played a playing style that I thought would be competitive and hard to beat. And so that also is quite specific to in the types of people that you target and the types of people that you want in your team. So yeah, there was a lot of factors to it. And I think when you're recruiting from scratch, and you know, it's very difficult to be able to build a team when there's nothing in place in terms of you're relying on players to make a commitment early, so then you can start building around certain players. So it was a constant puzzle piece, but really impressed with the group that we've ended up with. And again, you know, the investment we've made in these athletes, they're rewarding us with great performances on the court. So yeah, recruitment is not easy, but I think, you know, considering the challenges we were faced, I think we got it really, really right. And more in particular, what they're bringing to the culture and the environment and their buy-in to being part of a team and the selflessness of those individuals has been fantastic to work with. So a really great foundation and really excited for what the years to come look like for Leeds Rhinos Netball.
This was a question I was going to ask a little bit later on, but I'm going to ask it now just because of a couple of things that you said there. One of the other challenges that any coach faces is getting the most out of their players. And it appears, for the most part, at Leeds Rhinos, as if across the first 8 or so games, things are going pretty well at the moment. One thing I wanted to ask was about your approach to coaching such a mixed age of players, and naturally reputations within that squad at the moment at Rhinos. You've got athletes born post-millennium, and then you have some of the international superstars who have been around the elite level for years, such as Jade Clark, as you've mentioned. How do you personally go about building relationships with or getting the most out of those different relationships? Is it player by player? Is it relying on Jade to take a responsibility with younger players? Are there values and behaviours that you just expect across the board from yourself, players, coaching staff? How do you manage that as a coach?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you kind of hit a lot of things in that question as well, around all of those factors are really important. I think one of the biggest ones for me in terms of my coaching philosophy is that no matter what athlete comes into the team, no matter what age they are, no matter what background, no matter what level of experience, culture, etc., every single person in that team has a role to play, and the role they need to play is for the team. So I don't care if you're the oldest, the youngest, whatever, you've got an opinion, you've got a voice, you've got a role, and that comes with a commitment to make a contribution to the team no matter what. And what I've been really clear with the players in this year in particular is that this is your team. So the contribution you make, the behaviours you demonstrate, and the performances you put forward determine the success of our team in all of the ways that you measure success. It's not just about winning and losing a netball match. It's around building a culture. It's around building an environment. So that element is really critical. Team first, people, and actually having people that are willing to sacrifice themselves to see someone else shine is a skill in itself. And that's something I'm very big on the athletes that I want in my team, because I think the best teams will always beat the teams that have the big names and the superstars if they're willing to be selfless and play for each other, which is kind of what we're trying to create. I think too, the other part is when it comes to on court is that every athlete has to understand the role they have to play for the team, even if it's a role that is above and beyond or a little bit below or a little bit different to the role they may want to play. If it's in the best interest of the team, they need to buy into it because it's what the team needs from them. So, you know, I've got a couple of players that have to play a little bit out of their preferred position because that's what the team needs. I've got players that aren't in the starting lineup but have a role to play for 5 minutes or a quarter or whatever, and learning how to embrace that role for the team is really critical. And at the end of the day, it all comes down from a coaching perspective around the relationships you have with each individual athlete, because as you touched on in the question, you can't, with coaching, it's not one size fits all. So while I might coach the team under a certain philosophy and under certain ethos and use a common language for the group, the way I coach and interact with every single athlete is different because the relationships vary from person to person. So I might have a very serious surface level relationship with one athlete, and I might have a very humorous, lighthearted relationship with another athlete, but that's what's required for us to understand each other. And it's how we connect and engage. And I really try to create an environment that it's not all about me as the coach, and it's not all about the big name marquee players. Every single one of us has a role to play. We're all a piece in the puzzle, but no puzzle piece is more important than the next. So just creating that's really important. And it comes down to your transparency and your honesty with communication. And, you know, you can see how many factors actually go into that. And I answered the question, I think, you know, in a number of different ways, but all of those elements actually allow it to come to life. And not one element is more important than the next. They're all connected, which makes it, I think, as, from my perspective, it's the stuff that I really love in coaching. I think it's what makes me, I guess, unique as a coach, because while I love the technical, tactical side, you know, the mechanics that we all have to do and that we all do relatively well as coaches, the dynamics and understanding human behavior and the people you work with and how they think and operate actually is where your most gains are made. So for me, that's the stuff that I love because I'm curious by nature. So I'm fascinated by human behavior. And coaching is a great job to work in if that's what if that's what gets you going.
You talk about the relationships and everyone understanding their role and the purpose of the team. What were those initial ambitions and goals set that everyone was working for at the start of the year? Was there a immediate win goal? Was there a safety net of we are new into the Super League? Where did you sit on the spectrum, I guess?
Yeah, so there were two parts, I think, coming into the season and also in the recruitment phase with athletes. Is the first thing I said to each athlete is I said, I don't want Leeds Rhinos to be your ceiling. So if this is your ultimate goal just to play for Leeds Rhinos, I want you to aspire for more. So my priority was to make sure that I had athletes that had a real hunger and inner drive to be their absolute best and to get everything out of their talent and potential and to use this opportunity as their platform and their catalyst to be better than they've ever been before. And what I would always say to the athletes is that I will provide you with all of the training environment, all of the content, all of the knowledge, all of the support, criticism, everything you need to do what you need to do, but you are going to be the one that does it. So I'll hold your hand to a certain extent, but I'm not going to do it for you. Everything you need is in front of you, and your job is to take control of your own athletic journey. So that was one thing that we're very big on in the team, is that we own what we do. What we get is what we earn, and what we earn is what we deserve. So really trying to get that embraced in the group. When it comes to the actual team, and a lot of people ask that question, oh, what were your expectations in the first year? And my response to it is, well, there weren't any, because we as a group had no right to put a ceiling on where we could be because we'd never, ever played a game together. So I was not going to cap the group on, oh, we could go here, we could go here. But what we did make sure that we were always focused on was measuring our success by our progress and demonstrate our learning session to session, week to week, month to month, game to game. And that's been my philosophy from the very start. So, you know, each week is catered for where we're at to where we need to go, as opposed to thinking too far down the line. It's always quite progressive and gradual. And I think the first five games, I'd say in the season, we went into it obviously embracing loving playing, which is important, and a real focus on our level of competitiveness and following our processes in how we want the game to be played. So there was never from me any, we must win this game, this is a winnable game. There was none of that type of talk with the group. It was around, all right, let's focus on this today. Let's follow the process here. And if we do this really well, we're going to be very competitive, or we're going to be very, very competitive. So a real focus on processes and not too much identification around outcomes. As we kind of got five games in, we all, and I knew this would happen, but I wanted the players to get there and understand it themselves more importantly. I wanted them to acknowledge that we were more than capable of winning matches against top quality sides. And so when you acknowledge and you have that deep belief because you've seen it and you've felt it, the expectations or the standards and the benchmarks and the accountabilities can be risen. And that's what we've kind of shifted over the past last three or four games as such, where we know that we have talent. We know that we work hard and that talent results in a high quality performance when we're playing at our best. And we also know that we have a team that is very difficult to beat when all the mechanics are functioning well. So we've slightly shifted to be a little bit more ruthless in what we expect come game day, the quality of netball that we play, the quality of performances in which we execute at training. And that's been fascinating working with the group in making that shift from, well, let's see where we're at, to, well, we know we've got some potential now. Let's raise our standards and see how far we can go. So there's still no ceiling or benchmark on what we're looking to do. It's around improvement and gradual gains, but it's also around maintaining the high standards that we're setting. And every time we surpass them, we have to raise the standards again. So it's around that constant high performance drive, sustained performance, and going above and beyond as often as we can and as far as we can. So that's the fun part about this team, particularly when there's no history. You're not protecting a ranking. I don't think many people are expecting us to be in the top four, but we sit probably at the halfway mark in a really healthy position. Teams really get up to play us. They play well against us, which is a sign of respect, which is nice. But we're just loving competing. And to be honest, seeing how well we compete, considering we've only got a history of 9 games together. So it's been exciting and really fulfilling.
It's a fascinating concept. And we spoke on the podcast a couple of weeks ago to Emir Humphreys, who's the academy director at Huddersfield Town Academy. And they completely restructured their football academy. And they were talking of similar ideas that they've tried to implement in terms of actually certain people have to play out of position for the team's benefit, for their own benefit. But actually, they're in an academy setup, so they're building for a first team. So their ultimate end goal is slightly different to a win now, or waiting for the players to recognize, actually, yes, I'm a big striker, so I'm going to go and play out on the wing to improve my footwork, but actually ultimately that improves me as a footballer. And similar ideas of actually, I need to play slightly out of position to benefit the netball seven for the end result, for the end season, those sort of short process goals, outcome goals. You can't almost fall one side or the other. And I guess ultimately where I'm going with that is that because Emir always has the first team as his end goal, he's almost judged on how many players he gets through the academy at Huddersfield into their first team. What does your end goal look like at Leeds Rhinos, and when, or is it still too early to say that as well?
Yeah, I think for me, like I said, it's all around the process and the step-by-step, because I think if your process and your systems are robust and in place and sustainable, then results and outcomes really do take care of yourself. So I think in the players that we've recruited, there's probably a core group of around 5, 6, or 7 that are only naturally going to get better, which then gives the team a really strong identity to be built around year upon year. So you look at players like Rhea Dixon and Brie Greeson and Sienna Rushton, these young 19, 22, 23-year-olds that have really emerged as well-established Super League players, but still in the infancies of their careers, to then carry on what we've started this year. So again, it's not so much around who the coach is and how long the coach will be there, or how long the senior player will be there. It's around ensuring that the program delivers performance and improved performance, and that the playing group is sustainable and consistent and builds a really clear identity and continues to evolve the identity as it goes on year upon year, and that we have a great support staff system and network. We have great resourcing. And if all of those things can be maintained and continue to add value each year we go along, then I actually think that's when the success actually happens. Because we in recruitment did not go out to try and buy a premiership in the first year. It wasn't of interest to me. I don't think that's a smart way to build a franchise from the ground up. So what I presented to the club was really around, you need to start thinking a little bit more long-term, hence why our average age is 22 years of age. And also knowing too that there is the pathway at Leeds Rhinos Netball that sits underneath our Super League, that there needs to be a strong link and correlation between bringing those players up through to Super League in time too. So I'm a real big believer on the processes, obviously, and it is around the system, the structure, the sustainability, the infrastructure, and the consistency year upon year, which actually allows you to be successful. And all the clubs that we see in Super League or in any sport that have sustained success, it comes from robust pathways that prove to filter through athletes to the top. It comes from great programming. It comes from world-class coaching, not just technical and tactical, but strength and conditioning, nutrition, all of those other elements. And it has all the resourcing it needs to be truly high performance and elite. And if you have all those resources and you have the athletic talent within the players and they buy into the culture, naturally, the progression is to get better and better and better. And again, when working with a team like Leeds Rhinos and having the support of the rugby who live and breathe high performance sport, it's a competitive industry. So you're always looking for ways to do things better and to find that winning edge. And that is the difference between, you know, the top clubs and the bottom clubs. But I actually think whatever happens in the future, the way we've set it up in this first year actually gives us a chance to dream big in the years to come. And it might not result in premierships immediately, but I think it's all around ensuring that it's set up well enough to give yourself the chance of getting to that state. So, yeah, process, most important thing, because the process is a reflection or a result of the winning or losing. You can't win and lose without the process. So don't spend too much time worrying about the outcome and where you want to go. Worry about how you're actually going to get there day to day. That's the stuff that matters.
You've spent some time coaching in the Super League before. You've then spent some time out in the Suncorp, and you've also coached internationally. Is there anything that's taken you by surprise on court from what you've seen across those first 8 or 9 games so far this season?
I've been really surprised by the amount of comments that have come back around how physical Leeds Rhinos are. And it's not physical in a dirty sense, which is, I think, where some people kind of get it a little bit mixed. But my team plays a very hardworking, honest, in-your-face for 48 minutes the entire game, which is, from an Australian, that is how the game is played in Australia. So as a former Suncorp Super Netball coach, when you're sitting on the side of the court, the game is absolutely brutal. So when I hear coaches over here or fans or whatever comment around the level of physicality, it's almost like chalk and cheese for me. While the Super League is becoming more physical, it is, in comparison to Australia and New Zealand, worlds apart. And I actually think the league needs to become more physical, more assertive. And in doing that, the players need to train more. The programs need to be more full-time orientated training programs to improve the overall product of the game. So I think we're seeing better defensive games from all teams. And they all play very different styles. We're the only team that really plays hard, one-on-one, in your face, relentless for the full 48 minutes, which I guess makes us a little bit unique. And I guess reflective of my Australian coaching style in terms of what I value. Quite a lot of errors in some teams as well, where, you know, some poor skill and execution errors that I think need to be tidied up to improve the overall quality of what we're putting out there. But all in all, I still think the league is moving in a really positive direction. There's some great players, world-class players playing across all franchises, which is brilliant for the league. And a full credit to England Netball and the Super League for the product they're actually putting out there, the broadcast quality, the entertainment, the package that it comes across. And even for us, you know, playing in a venue where there's no crowds, the atmosphere is absolutely awesome and the production is fantastic. So, yeah, there's a lot of differences, I think, between the Super League and the Australian leagues. And obviously, you know, I've got a bit of an insight in that compared to other coaches. I've actually sat on a sideline of a Suncorp Super Netball game and felt what that's like. There is a huge gap between that league and the Super League, but the potential in the Super League is enormous, and really pleased to see it heading in the direction that it is. And hopefully this is just the start of a really prosperous future for the league here in England.
You touched on the package there in terms of what you're putting out, and naturally, to some extent, the higher quality of performance that is showcased, the more eyeballs are on the sport. But one of the major things that is happening with netball at the moment, the Super League, that Sky Sports are showing every single game, either on TV when scheduling allows or on their YouTube channel. It's accessible for viewers to see, to catch up on far more easily than having to check a social media to see what the result was of a game that's been played. Surely that's got to be massive for the sport. And as you say, naturally as the game tidies up a little bit in terms of execution of skills and bits and pieces, but actually just people watching it and seeing, actually, this is good to watch. This is entertaining sport. And it might be that the first people watch it because scheduling allows it. There's no other live sport going on, which is hard at these times when it seems it's everywhere. But people watch it, they find a team, they latch onto the Rhinos, and they think, actually, I'm going to follow their progress through each week, and actually, I'll jump onto the YouTube to watch it. So that package that Sky are putting together, which possibly started a long time ago, but certainly feels as though it came to fruition a little bit with that All-Stars series and the replacement of the Jamaica series. You've got someone like a Tamsin Greenway giving the most elite insight, analytical knowledge that sitting there as a non-knowledgeable netball fan, I'm thinking, goodness me, I think I could go and play goal defence or wing attack now because she's explained it so clearly to me. You wouldn't want to see me playing either of those positions, but I try. But that sort of idea of the package, it's not just there's been a netball game, this was the result now. And that's got to help grow the sport, surely.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the silver lining of COVID in the fact that we have a centralized venue where all teams play under the one roof, to be totally honest, is probably the only reason why Sky is able to broadcast all of the games in the way they are. So the fact of the matter is that we are getting access like we have never had before. We are getting to follow our teams or gravitate towards new teams. Teams are getting new loyal supporters. We're learning about new players, new coaches. We're able to follow the stories as they evolve, which is what the majority of other sports in the world get to do. But the Super League has always been one or two games a week on TV, and the rest of the time you're trying to scroll through Twitter to see score updates, and that's no way to follow a professional league. So if the Super League is serious around trying to commercialize and professionalize its product, it needs to be visible and it needs to be presented in a way that is slick and tidy and entertaining, which is exactly the way Sky are packaging, and I think they're doing a fantastic job. The thing that I worry about is what happens next year, considering there may not be a central venue. So what capability or capacity do Sky have in terms of getting that amount of games broadcast again? Because the reality is we really do not want to go back to playing in high school gyms on courts where there's 100 different lines going on, because what it actually looks like on TV at the moment is a professional product that you would see in Australia, New Zealand at a major competition. We cannot afford as a sport here to take a backward step. The benchmark has now been set where a netball fan or a sports fan that is now following netball, they want to see every single game. They want to follow their favorite players, follow their favorite teams. They want to follow it up with press stories. That if we go in a different direction next year and we don't keep this traction, it's going to be a huge opportunity lost for the sport in this country. And I think I've been quite outspoken around the central venue that this is the way forward for netball in this country. That then means that you may have to sacrifice a home and away season. But can't we think about maybe the option of a central venue, huge arena, roadshow around the entire UK to actually get all teams in the one venue? One week we're at Manchester Arena, the next week we're at First Direct Arena in Leeds, then we're at the O2 Arena in London, and actually have the roadshow where it allows Sky to broadcast every single game. Fans may have to travel more, but the commercialization of the game has to come from a broadcast capacity, which the more it's broadcast, the more sponsors come in board and want to get a part of the product. But if it's not visible, no one is going to be interested. So it's such an interesting time for the sport here, because I've been blown away by the media coverage and the interest. And even for us as a brand new team, that, you know, people are really loving the way we play the game, but they're loving the players in the team. They're loving the journey. And if they didn't have the coverage, no one would have any idea that in round two, we lost three players and all these young kids are now doing a great job stepping up. So the fact that we can share the stories is because we can broadcast the games. And if we can't broadcast the games, no one's going to care. So it's going to be a really interesting time to see what next year looks like. And, you know, whether there are clubs that are willing to sacrifice home and away seasons. And obviously that means loss of revenue. So how can the league subsidize that or support that? But the reality is too, that a lot of these clubs at the moment sit in this very gray area around amateur status, semi-professional, and some wanting to be professional and ready to do it, but others not willing to find more investment or find more funding to kind of climb the ladder and get to that professional scope. So my fear is that there'll be some franchises that get left behind, and the challenge will always be, does England Netball and the Super League stick to the status quo and try and keep everyone happy, or do they make some bold moves to really throw the game into a professional capacity, and only those that can manage a professional environment or a professional infrastructure or a commercialization of their own product are the ones that survive. It's there's so many talking points of that, but it's such a critical time for this game in the UK, because I really do believe the silver lining with COVID has been the central venue and Sky Sports coverage of it. That anything less than what we're seeing right now will be an enormous missed opportunity if we don't capitalize.
I'm almost just imagining a sort of Premier League darts style roadshow around the place. They take over one of these venues for a weekend. And that magic weekend rugby league style idea. It's exactly as you say, it's the absolute perfect thing to be able to do if it's possible. And I'm sure the relevant people having those conversations with someone like yourself pushing that idea forward, it'll get listened to. There is another topic that I want to move on to a little bit, and maybe again, moving away from the status quo to some extent. So now may well be the bridging point. But you are an Australian. As a youngster in Australia, as you mentioned, you played an awful lot of netball, mixed and men's netball, through the age groups and beyond to the elite level down under. So netball has always been part of your life, so to speak, without speaking for you. But in the UK, male involvement is growing, but it isn't huge. There are an increasing number of male netball clubs popping up around the country. There are plans in place for the EMMNA to host a 2021 tournament for men's and mixed netball, and therefore things are improvements. Have you ever felt a pressure or any additional bias or anti-bias during your time coaching in netball as probably the most prominent male figure to carry the flag for men's netball to some extent within even the UK recently?
It's a good question. And I think a lot of people are always curious about me because I guess I am a little bit in the minority being a male coaching a female dominated sport. However, I think for me, it's all in the perception. It's all in the eye of the beholder type of thing. I've never really seen myself as anyone different in the sport since I was an 8-year-old kid. And I think it's because I've been a part of the game since my early days, and I've gone through the exact same pathways as any other player, coach that has been a part of the game their whole time. So I've never had an easier ride. I don't believe I've had a tougher ride. I think that I've always embraced every opportunity, and I've always sourced my own opportunities, and I've always invested my time in working hard, refining my craft, and I've really earned everything that I've got, essentially, just like any athlete and just like any other coach in the majority of high performance sports. I'm a big believer that coaching doesn't have a gender. It has a skill set, it has attributes, it has qualities, but it's certainly not pigeonholed by whether I'm a male or a female. So it's an industry and a career around experience, credentials, who you are, what you stand for, and how you deliver your job. I just happen to be a male and I coach female athletes, and my athletes don't see me any different than any other coach. And I'm Dan Ryan first, I'm Dan Ryan the coach second. And that's always been how I've seen it. And I do take great pride in the fact that I have been able to find a way to make a living out of my passion, because it took until the only time where I believe that I could be a head coach or a coach and have a career as a coach was in 2014, because that was up until that point, coaching was always just a hobby. And then Rob Wright, who was the first, or one of the first head coaches in the professional era of Australian netball. He was appointed head coach at the New South Wales Swifts, and he's now an assistant coach in the New Zealand ANZ Championship League. But he was the first male appointed as a head coach, and me seeing him get appointed to that role was the penny drop moment for me, going, well, if Rob can do it, I'm going to be next. I can do this. So that's when my focus shifted to being, you know, striving on that high performance coaching journey. And I think for me, I take great pride in the fact that I've been able to, I guess, essentially live a lot of my career dreams and strive to where I've wanted to get to and create this life and this career that I have through my hard work, dedication, and really my life's work investing into netball to be where I am today. And I know that there are people that are looking up to me and admiring what I've done. And I take great pride and responsibility in that, because all it took for me to really shift my focus around coaching being a hobby to a career was seeing Rob get a job. And then I thought, I can be next. I can do this. And I get a lot of messages every now and then, be it on social media or whatever it might be. And even some parents from young boys who see me and see where I am and see, I guess, the passion that I have for the game, but all of the roles, be it, you know, captaining Australia or commentating or coaching, that they see an avenue for their son or whatever it might be as well. So, you know, I definitely, you know, without putting any pressure on myself, embrace the role of being a role model or an ambassador for men in netball, but I don't champion it to the fact that I'm any different to anybody else. And I don't like that. I like that I am welcomed and I belong in netball because I'm good at what I do and I am passionate about the game. I don't get any favors, and it's not any easier for me or harder for me because I'm a male. I choose to see it as I fight for everything I get and I'm good at what I do, therefore I get the rewards in the end. And I hope that there are a lot of other males out there that see that, but also too, I hope that there are a lot of females that see that too in other sporting codes where perhaps they're the one in the minority. So you see a lot of, you know, women football coaches that and women basketball coaches, for example, too. I love seeing those women appointed into those roles where it's kind of, again, it challenges the status quo. However, as I said before, coaching doesn't have a gender and it never should. The armchair critic will quite often put a gender on coaching. However, coaching isn't knowing the game. Coaching is science. Coaching is human behavior. Coaching is psychology. Coaching is understanding yourself. There's so many factors. And you're not good at coaching because you're a male or a female. It's because you've got all those competencies and all those different skill sets. So, yeah, to answer your question, no extra pressure, or it hasn't been easier or harder for me because I've seen myself as no different. It can certainly be harder if you see yourself as different and you feel like you've got a chip on your shoulder. But I certainly think that, you know, if you work hard and you're good enough at what you do, you will get to where you want to get to if it's a part of your journey. So, yeah, embrace the role of being a role model and hope that I can certainly be a source of inspiration for others to follow my path. And because my journey too, it hasn't been a straight line. It, working in high performance sport isn't linear. It's like riding a wave. There's ups and downs and swings and roundabouts, and navigating your way through that is part of the fun. So if you want something bad enough, find a way to make it happen. And more often than not, you'll get there.
And for what it's worth, I think you absolutely carry that role of role model, whether it's a label that you want or don't want. I think you do brilliantly for male coaches within sport, full stop. But part of that, again, like part of the question is ultimately the more males involved in netball and seeing netball as a sport and for the enjoyment that it can bring. And I would be the first person to say that I love watching it because it is incredibly high pace, and I will try and convince people till the cows come home that actually just give it a chance, give it 10 minutes on YouTube, give it a quarter on YouTube, whatever it may well be. I know that Knights men's netball are doing an awful lot of good work and they are starting to sort of reap the rewards themselves a little bit. They are training partners at two or three of the franchises and were involved with the England Roses camp. They've set up a league. They've got men's netball on the map, so to speak, without using another cliche. Is the quality there for men's netball to get something off the ground here from what you've seen of those guys when they're playing? I know you've been involved again at the big showdown and know one or two of those guys, but then what more needs to be done, or what can we take from Australia and New Zealand to grow it from the bottom up ultimately?
Yeah, I think I have enormous respect for all the guys that are part of that night setup, and also all the other franchises that are kind of popping up around the country, because these are people that are so passionate about the game. And, you know, with no funding and no support, really, they're doing it for their pure love of the game, to provide opportunities for people, or for men and mixed teams as well, to experience the game and the greatness that the game can give to your life and the fulfillment of playing the sport. I think they've done an amazing job, and they're absolutely on the right track. The sport, the men's game over here, probably sits a little bit more in a participation space than a high performance space. And again, the high performance element will come over time. There needs to be the improvement in the growth of the numbers, which is the awesome stuff they're doing to have 5 or 6 clubs and franchises popping up in the different regions of the UK, which again, it's all about a process, and you can't get to the very top without starting at the very bottom. And they're doing a great job in providing opportunities first and foremost for participants to get involved in the game, to then start on a pathway to the elite level, and ideally representing the England men's or mixed team against the other best countries in the world. So it's all a work in progress, and the starting point is now starting to come. The end point is there. They know where they want to get to. And I think the work they're doing and the acknowledgement they're getting from the Super League franchises in terms of the training partners and training associates. I've got a couple of guys that are involved in Leeds Rhinos as well from the Northern Titans, which is really important. And then obviously the acknowledgement from the England Roses to come into the program. This is stuff that has been happening in Australia and New Zealand for decades. So, but I think what's different here now is that the growth that has happened in the past 4 years has been astronomical. I remember when I was first in the UK in 2016 coaching Manchester Thunder, there were no men's teams playing. When I came back in 2019, there were a number of different men's teams, and the men's game had grown, and it had become a game where you, if you wanted to be a male and play a game of netball, you had access to it, where 3 years previously, there wasn't anything available to you. So the growth is awesome. And I think it's going to continue to grow if we keep pushing it. And I think too, like, if you look at countries like New Zealand, who I think are the most progressive in terms of embracing men's netball, the fact that they televise a Cadbury series, the New Zealand men versus the New Zealand women, and the fans and the general sporting public absolutely love it. And the men now start to have a bit more of a profile, be it individually or collectively as a team. The fact that they embrace the men in the game as a part of their community and a value add to their overall product of the game is brilliant. Australia is a little bit more protective of their game in they acknowledge that men play. However, they fully don't embrace it under their Netball Australia banner. IFNA doesn't embrace men's netball as a game either, because they're quite protective of netball being a game for women, where I'm always a big believer of power in numbers. And I think if anybody, particularly men involved in netball, there is no desire for men to take over netball whatsoever. Men just want to be involved because they have a great passion for the game. So to deny somebody or anybody that has a huge passion for the sport is criminal, in my opinion, because if you've got people that want to help and want to get the game bigger and stronger and out to all of the areas of the world, I think it's an enormous positive. And understanding that, you know, netball in some parts of the world is unique for women because it's their thing, and there's a lot of things that get taken away. I think that, you know, what one of the things that does hold netball back at times is it's women's sport, selling point of it being unique. However, why can't netball be the number one sport for everybody and rival all of the sports on the planet and make it the greatest game of all? That would be my vision. Don't counteract 50% of the population, power in numbers, and make netball the highest participation sport, full stop.
It's something certainly that as a teacher, I want to get more of from lower down, get them involved as part of PE curriculum, whatever it may well be, and transferable skills across the board, even if they don't stick with it because they don't enjoy it. But that's the same as rugby, as football, whatever. They might not enjoy it and they might not continue it past the age of whatever, but the transferable skills they learn from any sport, any activity, any healthy lifestyle behaviours. And then people grow from there, don't they? But Dan, I don't want to keep you any longer. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking to you. It's been a fascinating insight into the growth of a sports franchise, into high performance coaching, and obviously into growing the game as well. We really appreciate your time. Wish you and Leeds Rhinos all the very best of luck moving forward. We'll be following the journey as closely as we can, and hopefully crowds are allowed back in soon, whether that's part of the roadshow or beforehand, but we'll hopefully see you soon.
Thanks so much, mate. Been a pleasure.
Cheers, Dan.
Brilliant. Massive thanks to Dan for his time. And of course, good luck to him and the Leeds Rhinos team for their upcoming fixtures and the remainder of the season. I'll be sure to follow along as much as I can via the Sky Sports YouTube and channels. I think it's great to see netball given that platform, as Dan mentioned in that conversation. What they do next is going to be very important to ensure that eyeballs stay on the game, to ensure it can continue to grow. And I'm sure Sky Sports will support that throughout. But Tinner, shall we close with a little prediction before we go?
Go for it.
It's Masters week. Wasn't too long ago since we last made a pick for the Masters in their November edition, but now back in its usual place in the spring, the first major of the year. The best golfers in the world have decamped to Augusta National. I've got Jimmy's picks. He sent me his. So I'll go through his first and then I'll come to you. So Jimmy has had a sweepstake of sorts with his work colleagues where they've had to pick players from certain pools, so to speak, to get the lowest finishes, etc. So his picks from Category 1 are Bryson DeChambeau and Justin Thomas. From Category 2, he has gone for Matt Wolf. He's then picked Kevin Kisner in Category 3 and Henrik Stenson in Category 4. So he's not here to justify his picks. I think they're quite solid. I quite like them. I think he might have a decent chance of winning the office competition with those picks. But if he does, he's not here to justify them. Tinners, we only need to give one name, myself and you. So who is your pick to win the Masters?
I'm going to go with Rory McIlroy purely because I think it's probably going to be at that time where he's going to try and turn something on to get this one in his pocket kind of thing. I think it's the one that he doesn't have, and it's the one that he's obviously desperately wanting. And I think just looking back a little bit and what's been going on the last few months, not that I'm, like I said at the start, massively into my golf, but I am into the British athletes doing well. I think he's spot on to get in there for this one. So yeah, I'm going to go with Rory.
Yeah, I think it's going to be one of the big boys. You know, I'm similar thinking to Jimmy. Actually, I said in November I didn't think Bryson would do it then, but I think he could now with this long distance running slightly firmer. He might get a bit more. Justin Thomas has just won. Rahm, as we mentioned in the headlines, has just had a kid. So could that be a new perspective, bounce, etc.? As you mentioned, Rory's going for that career slam. And I think he's coming in a great space in terms of a little bit under the radar, not so much pressure on that. Dustin Johnson's defending. Sergio's playing well. Westy's playing well. I could probably convince myself there's a case for about 25 players, I reckon. And I'd probably believe it. So I'm trying to stay away from backing all 25 and then losing. But I do think it's going to be one of those big names. I think for that reason, I'm going to back Justin Thomas. I think having won at the Players, not having a terrific record round Augusta, I think it's about time he showed up. So that is what I'm backing. I think JT to win, to put all the bad press behind him after his slur, after being dropped by Ralph Lauren, etc. I think he's coming good. And I hope people begin to back him and trust him again. But that's me. It'd be interesting to watch. That'd be me for the four nights this week, sat in front of the TV, following along to that. So don't try and distract me too much. Don't disturb me. I'll be taking it all in. If any of the Brits do well, I think McIlroy is probably the one. I'd like to see him do something. But other than that, enjoy your cricket over the weekend.
Thanks, mate. You too. I'm sure I'll see you at some point for a social distance pint. But yeah, I'm sure we'll see you.
Don't get too stiff. Stay warm. Keep your layers on.
I'm the cat with the bass and drum going around like bum, bum, bum.